From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program would not be possible without the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please know how very thankful we are for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Happy Independence Day, everybody. Here's a quick confession. With the holiday weekend upon us, we would ordinarily be firing up the barbecue and presenting a patriotic red, white, and blue best of edition of State of Belief Radio. But the late-breaking news out of the Supreme Court last Friday came too late for us to properly address it on last week's show, and so we have a fresh new edition of State of Belief for you today. And it's entirely appropriate. For many years, Interfaith Alliance, as an organization, and I personally, have worked for the day that marriage would be available to all Americans. We firmly believed that this would make us a better country and a fairer people. As many of us continue to celebrate the extension of these rights to our LGBT brothers and sisters nationwide, there is no reservation to my describing marriage equality as an eminently moral and an eminently American value. So it's easy to rejoice over the new step toward freedom as a part of our celebration of Independence Day this weekend. So I say it again, Happy Independence Day, everybody.
We're turning the essentials of government on its head by allowing the Supreme Court to make what I believe was an illegal, unconstitutional power grab.
Part of our celebration will be a look at what it took to get us to this moment, as well as the work that remains to be done with Interfaith Alliance Executive Director Rabbi Jack Moline, who will be with us later in the show.
Designated to speak on behalf of liberal culture at the monument's commemoration, he started thinking about the country in terms of cooperation across difference, and he started representing America as an ideal of equality that could shape behavior as powerfully as religious ideals shaped an indeterminate life.
As much as we bemoan conservative Christianity's inappropriate involvement in our secular government and politics, there are other stories to tell when it comes to the broad sweep of our nation's history and the broad religious impulses that helped inspire it. An intriguing new book from historian Amy Kittelstrom examines this history in the form of the stories of seven important historical figures, and you'll meet the author on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
most importantly, I'd like to thank John for loving me, for making me a better man, and for giving me something worth fighting for. I love you. This is for you, John.
It was almost exactly 2 years ago, June 29th, 2013, when the justices ruled on DOMA and California's Prop 8. The perfect person to celebrate with us was the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, the first openly gay man to be consecrated as bishop in the Episcopal Church. Bishop Gene Robinson continues to be the perfect voice for a time such as this, and so I am just delighted to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. Gene, thanks so much for being with us again.
Welton, I'm so glad to be with you. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
What was your first reaction when you heard the court's ruling on marriage equality?
You know, we thought that it was going to happen. So in one sense, it wasn't a surprise, but what was a surprise was my feeling of elation, and I don't know if fulfillment is too big a word to put on it. I never realized how much I did not feel like a full and equal citizen of this country, And so when this ruling came down and I felt that way, it was really much more overwhelming than I anticipated that it would be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just an astounding thing to have fought for this for some 30 or 40 years and then all of a sudden to have it be a reality. I was more moved than I suspected I would be.
Gene, can you talk about how you see this affecting LGBT people? The direct impact is obvious, but how about the power of this kind of validation on a deeper level?
I think there's no way to overstate the importance of this. I mean, one of the things that I find so moving is to remember that when the slaves were freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, the very first thing they wanted to do was to be legally married. It has long been the symbol of full participation and acceptance into the culture. Now, we know that African Americans haven't been fully accepted into the culture, which is why we see so much strife these days around race. But still, it meant to them that they were welcomed into the culture in a new way because as slaves, of course, they could not be married. And I think for gay and lesbian people, this welcome into the institution of marriage, at least civil marriage, just is a real marker along the road to full equality as American citizens.
Yeah.
It's my hope that we will use this momentum to do all of the other things that are needed now for the full protection of gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. I mean, we're in that very funny sort of patchwork quilt situation where in many, many states now, a gay couple can be legally married on Sunday and be fired the next morning at work simply for being gay because their boss read about their wedding in the newspaper. And there's no recourse in the courts. So there's still much work to be done, and I believe that this ruling will give us the forward momentum to finish up that work.
Gene, as you and I have experienced, and as we know, there's a lot of celebration going on right now, and for good reason. But in all honesty, there are also a lot of people who are afraid of this change. We've heard a lot of leaders, both religious and political, irresponsibly stoking fear instead of working for unity. So I think it's vitally important at this moment for us to be talking some about the folks caught in the middle, because the language of conflict and rebellion can't be the only thing they're hearing right now. So what would you say to these people?
You know, one of the ways in which I try to stay empathetic to my detractors and those who would speak against LGBT people and our full and equal rights, and the way I do that is to remind myself that these people are only believing what they were taught. This kind of attitude is learned behavior. It's not something born in us. And if it is learned, then it can be unlearned. And so I try to stay sympathetic by remembering that, really, they were taught this from their mother's knee and have always been told this was the way. And so for this change to come about, I think, raises an anxiety in them, and especially for religious people who were always taught that homosexuality was an abomination and despicable in the eyes of God. And now all of a sudden, many religious people are saying, we got that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the anxiety and the resistance comes from this fear that if the church got this wrong, then what else did it get wrong?
Yeah.
And this faith of mine, which I thought was unshakable, now people are asking me to go against the faith that I was taught, and if they're right about that, then what else will I be called upon to change? And, of course, all of us humans hate any kind of change. And so that's got to be very anxiety-producing for people.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I would say to them is God is still in heaven, and all will be right with the world. God is still in charge, and God will still be with us through this. And I think that over time, as we have seen in states, for instance, where marriage equality has been the law for quite some time, people look around and realize that, you know, not much has changed. The world still goes on as it does, and the world isn't coming to an end, and the sky isn't going to fall just because we allow gay couples and lesbian couples to pledge their lifelong love to one another.
Gene, you know, I was thinking just before we went on the air of an interview that I did with you and our much-missed beloved Bishop Jane Holmes Dixon. And I remember saying on that show that you and Jane have far more grace and patience than I think I would have ever had if I were in your position. A few days ago, maybe a day or two ago, you were in a meeting with Episcopal leaders. What was it like there this time, and how does that compare with some of the other times you've been there?
Well, as you know, Walton, the last 12 years since I was consecrated a bishop has been fraught with all kinds of difficulty, and for me, death threats and all kinds of things. And at this recent General Convention of the Episcopal Church, which is our major governing body, it's bishops and clergy and laity all meeting together, we did an astounding thing. We voted to change the canons and to create liturgies for marriage within the church for same-gender couples. I have to tell you, I was not at all sure I would live to see it. Mm-hmm. I believed it would happen, and I certainly worked for it. But again, when the votes were taken this past week, it was just an overwhelming sense of fulfillment and completion to see my own church embrace the institution of marriage for gay or lesbian couples. It's just an amazing thing. And you ask about the change. One of the big changes is that I don't know that I have ever been in the midst of such a holy and gentle and respectful conversation as the one that we had when we were debating those resolutions. And after the vote, which was rather overwhelmingly in favor of same-gender marriages in our churches, some of the major opponents to that came up to me and embraced me and said that they were happy for me, even though they didn't agree with what had happened. They were so glad for me and for gay and lesbian people throughout our church. So not only was the vote on the right side, and to my way of thinking, but the spirit within which that vote was taken was really quite astounding.
Gene, one last question, if it's not too intrusive. What have your prayers been like since the court ruled?
So my prayers, oddly enough, since the court ruling, have not been about gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. Because I know that the famous saying is true, that none of us is free until all of us are free. And so my prayers have really focused on African Americans in this country who live in quite a different America than those of us who are white live in. I think about the dreamers and other undocumented people in this country who just want a fair shot at being an American citizen. I think of people who live in wheelchairs or who live in poverty or any of those circumstances that puts them on the margins. And my great hope is that now the LGBT community, having secured these rights, will use our strength and our energy to fight for freedom and equality for all of these other groups, because as the saying goes, none of us is free until all of us are free.
The Right Reverend Gene Robinson is the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, a fearless advocate for inclusion of all people in both civil and religious communities. Gene has served as an inspiration for millions, and that most certainly includes me. Today, Bishop Jean serves as a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Jean, it really is a great day, and it's just a delight to be with you today and have you again in this situation on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Walton. It's a wonderful thing to be able to celebrate here with you.
When the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its decision on marriage equality, for many of us who have spent years working toward this day, it was a win that was a long, long time in coming, and we celebrate it. Joining me right now is Interfaith Alliance Executive Director Jack Moline. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure to be here with you, Wilson.
Well, let's start with a look back at some of the partnerships and alliances that helped get us to this historic moment in history.
We've had the privilege over the years to act in coalition with not just groups that are dedicated to marriage equality in specific and LGBT rights in general, but with people of goodwill from at least 75 religious traditions in the United States, and people who would not define themselves as religious or as people of faith. So this has been a very broad-based coalition for us over all these years, and we've all been diligent and very patient.
Jack, people say Interfaith Alliance is an organization that's concerned about religious freedom. Why have you all talked so much for so long about marriage equality?
Marriage equality is a matter of civil rights in this country, Welton, and as you and I both know, there is nothing human which should be alien to people of faith, which is to say that there are different ways of looking at what the demands of a life of faith are. But when it comes to providing opportunities for people in the United States of America, a secular society governed by the rule of law with the foundation of the Constitution, I think it's absolutely a matter of faith that we have to act for those who have been disadvantaged by some miscarriage of the law.
What was it like at Interfaith Alliance as the news broke on the Supreme Court's decision on marriage?
So I have to tell you that the news gods were not with us last week because everybody was not only caught off guard that this decision was issued on a Friday morning, but that so many things happened all at once. The staff was on its way to a meeting at the Department of Justice to talk about a different civil rights issue, which is the treatment of Muslims in American society, when this decision was handed down. And so we literally produced a response to it in the taxi ride on the way to the Department of Justice. We were absolutely delighted, but we had to wait till after lunch in order to celebrate because there was other pressing business we had to deal with.
My goodness. Jack, I want to talk some now about reactions that we have seen across the nation. There's a lot of scaremongering going on around the high court's ruling on marriage. What are your thoughts on the government officials, particularly national and local, who have just outright tried to call for defiance of the ruling?
So you and I and our supporters, Welton, have been on the other side of what the law mandates for a long time. Hard as we want to work for change, we still accept that the rule of law is what governs America. What I'm seeing now and what troubles me tremendously is that the people who found themselves in the majority before and now find themselves on the other side of that decision have suddenly abandoned their support for the Constitution and the rule of law. We have political figures who are calling for the impeachment of Supreme Court justices. We have political figures who are calling for a referenda on the tenure of Supreme Court justices and other federal judges. And it leads me to believe that their support for genuine American values is a sham. What they really see them as is a validation of their sense of privilege and dominance that they've enjoyed for, in my opinion, a little bit too long.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it is troubling to me that we have such words being spoken, not just by religious leaders, but by elected leaders, public officials in this country. And it has caused me to redouble my commitment to Interfaith Alliance and the work it does to protect both the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, because that's what the Constitution is all about.
Jack, what is your estimate on just how volatile the rhetoric of religious liberty is likely to get? How bad is it going to get because of this marriage decision?
Well, the rhetoric is going to get awful, but the rhetoric is already awful. We like to focus on things that are reported in the mainstream and conversations that are being had at whatever volume among people who have a certain amount of credibility on both sides. But you don't have to look very far, particularly on the internet, to see the shrill and hysterical claims that are being made. Our old friend Pat Robertson is persuaded that this means that we're now going to be forced to perform all sorts of sexual acts that we don't like because the Supreme Court is ruling in this matter in support mm-hmm. of marriage equality. So we're going to see ridiculous rhetoric. And what is important for us to do as people who consider themselves to be rational is to not be sucked into the hysteria of this rhetoric, mm-hmm. to ask everybody to calm down and talk about this in a manner that befits the law, and to recognize that nobody is going to be asked to do anything that their religion tells them not to do unless they've agreed to it ahead of time, mm-hmm. like by becoming a public official.
Jack, what are the next steps for Interfaith Alliance on the issue of LGBT rights?
There are going to be a lot of challenges, some of them on the national level, but more likely on the state and local level, to this decision and to other aspects of equality. And the watchful eye of Interfaith Alliance, our ability to rapidly respond to them and to mobilize our supporters in 50 states is going to be enormously important. I know that most of the people who listen to this show are already supporters of ours, and if they're willing to reach out to other people to help us with that as well, this effort, because it's been won on the global level, is now going to be atomized and attacked on state and local levels. We already saw it in Indiana. We've seen it in Louisiana. We've seen it in Texas, and there are other places as well. So our goal is to keep an eye on all of those places through the good people who work with us.
Do you think that people like Rick Santorum are right that this is going to be a major issue in the 2016 election?
Well, it becomes a major issue in the 2016 election if someone like Rick Santorum says it is, because he's one of the candidates. I think in the hearts and minds of America, this issue is decided, even if it's not settled. People have to deal with a change in the status quo in their internal landscape, not just in the external landscape. Mm-hmm. But I think there are plenty of people who are running for public office who are either unhappy with this decision at its basis or who are unhappy that the decision didn't go much farther than it did and who will attempt to make this more of an issue than the overwhelming majority of Americans are willing to tolerate. And I think that the referendum on that tactic will happen in November of 2016.
Yeah. What do you most worry about right now in relation to that decision, but in relation to everything else you're dealing with?
Well, I guess I would have to say that the thing I worry most about is fear-mongering.
Mm-hmm.
It is a powerful motivator for people, and it tends to obscure the truth of any situation. So my hope is that there will be people, especially supporters of those who are doing the fear-mongering, who will call them out and ask them to dial down the rhetoric so that we can have intelligent and productive exchanges mm-hmm. on what the next steps are in securing equality for all Americans.
Jack, it is really more important than ever to have great support for the work of Interfaith Alliance. Tell our listeners how badly we need their support and their talk with other people about what Interfaith Alliance is all about.
Welton, at the risk of slipping into the fear-mongering I was just criticizing, let me say that the challenges to religious freedom, to equality, to civil rights, and to the embrace of every religion and philosophy in this country have never been greater. We've won some major victories, but it has only shifted the battlefield. Therefore, Interfaith Alliance needs to be on the watch constantly and able to respond. We have a relatively small staff, as you know, and we have some wonderful people working in almost every state of the union for us. But without the resources to follow up on what we discover, well, an important voice is going to be missing in the efforts to secure the blessings of liberty for us and for our posterity, which is an especially important thing to remember as we come into this July 4th weekend. So my hope is that people who are listening, who are supporters, will not only increase their support for Interfaith Alliance, but ask their friends to join them in becoming torchbearers, giving us a monthly contribution, or making a major contribution during the course of the year. And I'll go even farther than that and say if someone can gather a dozen or 15 of their friends who might be willing to form the nucleus of support for us in a community, that I or someone from Interfaith Alliance staff or board will come out and meet with them and help them figure out exactly how we can do that.
Rabbi Jack Moline is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, thank you so much for being with us today, and have a very happy Independence Day.
You too, Al.
In this day and age, it's easy to categorize conservative thought as aligned with religious impulses and ascribe a more secular perspective to progressive agendas. But as inaccurate as that priority is in the present time, it's even more stark in an honest look at our nation's history. Important work in re-examining this relationship of religion and government has led to the publication of a new book titled The Religion of Democracy, Seven Liberals, and the American Moral Tradition. The author is historian Amy Kittelstrom, and I'm very pleased to have her join us right now on State of Belief Radio. Amy, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How would you define the religion of democracy?
I would describe it as a way of thinking about belief that developed with the democratic tradition that holds taking the essential equality and liberty of all people as guiding ideals, as ideals for practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's compatible with more particular religious commitments, but it's something that provides a way for people of different kinds of beliefs to go ahead and treat one another as equal. The way the word liberal is used today, for the most part, in our political conversation has to do with a commitment to a particular kind of function of the government in terms of providing for welfare programs and these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And that's fine insofar as our current strictly political conversation goes, but the way I discovered the evolution of what it meant to be liberal over America's past is that what it meant to be liberal originally was to be open-minded, mm-hmm, about different points of view, to include people regardless of their differences, mm-hmm, and to have some kind of commitment to progress. So that a liberal actually has to be open-minded and consider a whole range of policy options from, you know, whatever point of view they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And conservative, I think, I don't spend as much time defining it because it changes, mm-hmm, with whatever set of political issues is at hand.
Mm-hmm.
So even a conservative can't stand outside of time or outside of history. They're actually pegged to their moment.
You write about seven figures, each of whom you call liberal. What do they share in common? And I guess tell us who they are, if you don't mind.
the way I have it around these seven figures is a writing method for giving the reader a viewpoint to look through at the past to sort of inhabit that person's perspective. But there are a lot more people in the book than these seven individuals.
Right.
And it's not just going from one biography to another. It's more that each chapter has one of these figures that's the vantage point for the reader to help them see who else was alive and active and vocal in whatever time period.
Mm-hmm.
So that it starts in the 18th century and goes to the 20th century. The first one is probably the most controversial, and whether the term liberal applies to him or not, is John Adams,
mm-hmm.
our second president, founding father, defender of the Constitution, and so on. History has been unfair to him and has branded him a conservative who didn't believe in democracy, who was an elitist, and so on. He gave his life to the creation of American democracy, so that even felt unfair to him in his lifetime. But again, I'm using this term liberal to describe his orientation of trying to be open-minded and listen to people of different points of view. And in his case, it becomes anti-hierarchical in a way that really, really matters in the 18th century in the preparation for this radical experiment, American democracy, because he thought that how a person acted, their morals, said something about their worth. So even somebody who was very low in the colonial hierarchy, not a gentleman, just a working man, could be as excellent or even more excellent than somebody of an exalted position who abused his power.
Mm-hmm.
So John Adams gives us a view into that colonial period and, of course, the revolution and the founding of the Constitution. And then the chapters overlap in time. So we get to see the revolution again from the perspective of Mary Moody Emerson, who was a little girl at the time of the revolution, and her father, a minister in Concord, helped argue for independence and for this vision of democracy. And she was the aunt of Ralph Waldo Emerson. And she's important because her Christian piety is so central to her life. And at the very same time, she has this open-mindedness and inclusivity that I'm talking about. So when she was a young woman and across her long life, she was born just before the American Revolution, died during the Civil War, so she saw a lot of change. One of those was the controversy in the church that was established in New England over Calvinism and do you believe in predestination or infant damnation? These are very particular theological doctrines.
Mm-hmm.
She, on the basis of her Christian piety, her devotion to God, her reading the Bible and other things, discarded those doctrines, maintained her piety. So I think it really helps us overturn what you began by talking about, this idea that liberals are somehow impious and mm-hmm. fallen away and secular. Here's somebody who was absolutely liberal in that sense
mm-hmm.
and who prayed to God with all her might every day. So Mary Moody Emerson gives us a great view into that. And also some issues around being female in the early republic. She couldn't vote, you know, these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then following her, and also somebody she knew in her lifetime, is the minister, Reverend William Ellery Channing,
mm-hmm.
who is known, I suppose, as the father of Unitarianism. But he never called himself a Unitarian. He called himself a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And his ministry not only helped bring a lot of his was the generation, the first real generation, where a lot of people started calling themselves liberals.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a liberal, they would say. Mm-hmm. And what they meant by that is, I'm fine with being in a church where some people believe in predestination and others don't.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all committed to living a good life and having our beliefs show up in how we treat one another, and that includes treating one another as equals. And so for Channing, who's about the most privileged figure in American history because of the wealth of his family and, you know, their ties to the revolution and so on, he said in an address to the new working class, because the Industrial Revolution has now invented the working class, he says, you know, I rightfully belong to the great fraternity of working men, which on the one hand could make you laugh because he never worked a day in his life, right? Not with his hands. But on the other hand is a profoundly, again, egalitarian statement where he's saying workers can be as good as anybody, right? Mm-hmm. So that's William Ellery Channing. And that helps bring us up to the Civil War era. His arguments against slavery were similar to Mary Moody Emerson's and others in saying these slaves, these Africans, have the same divine potential as everyone, working man, well-born person, however it is, and they need to be able to develop that divine potential, so they need to be free. Slavery needs to end. So at least in New England, this is the vision of why slavery is wrong, because it's a wrong thing to do to human beings. So then on the other side of the Civil War, I have William James, arguably the most important American philosopher. So he's born in the 1840s. He dies in 1910. He helps come up with this philosophy called pragmatism that is about the effects of belief. What is the belief you hold, and how does it manifest in action? And that's this mechanism. In William Ellery Channing, I call it Christian pragmatism. Other places, I might call it practical idealism. That's actually how the religion of democracy works. Mm-hmm. If you take the equality of all people as a principle in your mind, well, how does that change the way you would treat them, actually? Mm-hmm. So these are some of the things I deal with. Now we're getting into the late 19th century. Industrial Revolution has really picked up, and now we have lots of immigration, we have no regulation, we have no minimum wage, we have no weekends, we have no protection of workers' rights, and he's one of the people who starts asking, is that an okay way to treat people? And the next three chapters all continue to work in that same terrain in terms of time. Mm-hmm. The next chapter is about Thomas Davidson, somebody nobody has ever heard of now, but at the time he died in 1900, his obituary said he was one of the 12 most learned men on the planet. Mm. So he had quite a reputation while he was alive. And in bringing him back into our minds, we see somebody who was an immigrant, came from Scotland, grew up poor, but because he was smart and had opportunities through education, he taught himself about half a dozen languages, read a bunch of books, came to the United States, went elsewhere also, and really had a life as a public intellectual who had personally discarded the particular belief, Christian belief, that he'd been brought up with, and he's the one who came up with this term, religion of democracy, because he had this vision of how different people freely interacting with one another as equals could help produce a higher social consciousness. And so his work is quite diverse, but at the end of his life, he was working with immigrant Jews from Eastern Europe on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, people who worked 14-hour days, 6 days a week, and so on, and who really inspired him by showing him what a good mind could do given the opportunity. So he taught them Aristotle, Plato, you know, the big stuff. And many of those went on to become major progressive reformers. It's really quite interesting what he did in a short time in a small community. But that shows the beginning of this transition where, at the beginning of the book with John Adams, he was really only thinking about propertied white males as having political rights, because that was revolutionary in 1776.
Sure.
By the time you get up to 1900, people think that former slaves and their descendants should vote, women should vote, immigrants should have rights. You know, it's really changing from what I call an Anglo-Protestant elite to a universal ethic that's inclusive across differences. So Davidson does that with the Lower East Side Jews. And then in the next chapter, William McIntyre Salter, another name most people won't have heard of, somebody who was really important in his time. Salter was a leader in the Society for Ethical Culture, which still exists today and was invented in the 1870s, as a way of having a religion, of ethics. Mm-hmm. The motto was deed, not creed. And it was founded by a Reformed Jew, Felix Adler, or I should say ex-Reformed Jew, because in his training to become a rabbi, he decided to leave Judaism behind and embrace this ethical culture approach. Salter became a leader in that organization, which is like being a minister. They had Sunday services, they had congregations and so on, with a huge emphasis on social action. So Salter was involved in the Haymarket Affair. He was an activist for the eight-hour workday. He circulated a petition to get the Haymarket anarchists released from jail. He adopted a Native American boy, he and his wife. He was involved in these different conversations around the birth, then, of modern liberalism. Mm-hmm. So you had begun by asking me about these definitions mm-hmm. of liberalism. Here you see in Salter the first calls for the government to counteract the power of corporations by protecting people's rights mm-hmm. in a way that wasn't happening at that time of high labor mm-hmm. disputes and so
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
And then the final chapter is Jane Addams. I have to confess, she's like the hero of my book, and she was hard to write about because, to be honest, I admire her quite a bit. Everybody mm-hmm. else I can find some faults with, but Jane Addams, who was the first American woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize, that was 1931. She died in 1935. Born in 1860, and over the 1890s, especially 1900s, her work through Hull House, the settlement house in Chicago that served so many working class families and immigrants and so on, had this approach, this sort of religion of democracy approach, knitted into its very foundation. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that was so striking for me in doing the writing is that all of the people in my book interrelate with one another, because mm-hmm. I worked through the sources in a way to create a fabric that actually existed in the past, and mm-hmm. so I'm bringing it into the present. Jane Addams also has these ties. Thomas Davidson was one of the founding advisors for Hull House. William McIntyre Salter lived in Chicago and often gave lectures and stuff there. And later in life, William James came to be an admirer of Jane Addams. Mm. And she read some pragmatism, too. And at the same time, even though she is connected to everyone, she came up with her approach to social change through experience, mm-hmm. through actually knowing her neighbors in the community and coming into it with the premise that she was not better than they were.
Mm-hmm.
So she really overturned the hierarchy of the Victorian middle class Anglo-Protestant reformer who's delivering charity down to the needy. Instead, she said, I'm getting as much from this relationship as they are. This is a reciprocal relationship. And together, we're going to take care of our collective needs. And that's how society should function.
As I listen to you, what you're writing about are people whom you call liberals, as you define them, characterized by equality, belief in equality of human beings, the dignity of humankind, an open mind, a understanding of the need for diversity, respect for different points of view. That is not the list of values that I would assign to many of the people who characterize our history as that of a Christian country. There has been a hijacking of our history and a revisionist history put in its place. And so when you talk about a liberal conversation between the 18th and the 20th centuries, could we add century 21 and say that you're giving us a corrected history of a very healthy kind of religion that was not exclusivistic, was not closed-minded, and that's where the conversation needs to begin. Those are the poles of it.
I agree, and I'm really glad to hear your way of putting that into your own words. This concept that we are a Christian nation and we always have been, There was, in the 19th century, also a movement to have an amendment to the Constitution, saying this is a Christian nation. So the argument's been going on in a long time, and it was one of the most exciting things for me to discover that there were actually Christians. At the time of the founding of the nation, Christians like John Adams, who did stand up for the separation of church and state and so on, religious freedom and all of that. So not only were there Christians involved in the founding who defended religious freedom, but they actually did it on these very grounds.
Right.
So if you want to give credit to that idea that America was a Christian nation, then Christianity has to mean not a particular set of beliefs involving the status of the Bible and the character of Jesus Christ's ministry. Yeah. It can't be that specific.
Right.
It has to be more general. And it has to be about this way of treating everybody as, like you say, dignity. If all men are created equal, taking that seriously says something about the way you need to treat those different people. And so, I think that in the 21st century, we should have a conversation about really what are these principles that the nation is committed to and how have they worked over time and how do they continue to empower us today. Partly because that helps us find a common ground where when we disagree with people on some issues, let's start and find some place where we do agree and work out from that into resolving those disagreements.
What's the one thing you would want every reader of this book to take away from it?
Well, I think it has something to do with the role of intellectual freedom, actually, in American life, political life, community life, wherever it is that you're applying your energies. This matter of thinking for yourself, listening to others when they disagree, while remaining true to your own commitments, this isn't just a hippie idea or a Thoreauvian idea, right? This is actually part of how you contribute to society with your unique character of mind.
Yeah.
You know, if the history illustrates how that has been done, I hope it empowers people today to have a commitment to their own intellectual integrity.
Dr. Amy Kittelstrom is a historian of modern thought and culture who specializes in 19th century American thinkers and their contexts. She's professor of modern U.S. history and transnational intellectual culture at Sonoma State University. Her very valuable new book is titled The Religion of Democracy, Seven Liberals, and the American Moral Tradition. Amy, I really want to thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio and letting us hear more about this book.
Wilton, thank you so much. I really appreciate your testimony and your platform and your good work in the world, too.
Now, before we go, there's been a lot of ink spilled and airwaves clogged since the Supreme Court's June 26 decision on marriage equality, with reactions that mostly fall along ideological lines. It would be great if those conservatives who recognize the basic equality reflected in the court's ruling continue to speak out and those uncomfortable with it commit to a genuine effort to protect the religious freedom of all Americans in a changed landscape. But far too many are engaged instead in extremist fear-mongering and intractable divisiveness, and that includes leaders within our secular government who have a responsibility to know better. So, as a public service, I want to take a minute to allay some of the worst fears, giving them the benefit of the doubt that what they say is sincere. Here's former House Speaker and prominent Texas conservative Tom DeLay.
Well, we've already found a secret memo coming out of the Justice Department. They're now going to go after 12 new perversions, things like bestiality, polygamy, having sex with little boys and making that legal. Not only that, but they have a whole list of strategies to go after the churches, the pastors.
You know, Tom DeLay has never liked the government unless it was doing precisely what he wanted the government to do. It is ludicrous to think that our government would even hint at discussions like those he mentioned. Tom DeLay is a fearmonger of the highest proportions. We best ignore him, or if we must think of him as someone who has always opposed the kind of democracy that we appreciate. U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Ted Cruz called the court's decision one of the darkest days in American history and called for subjecting the justices to a public retention vote every 8 years. He also asked this question.
Who in their right mind would design a system where every major public policy issue of the day is decided not by the people, not by the Constitution, not by elected representatives, but by nine elite lawyers in Washington, D.C.
You know, I find it almost incredible that a person who is seeking to be in the highest office in this land, the President of the United States, and he doesn't appreciate the basic structure of our government, the importance of all three branches of this government. But, you know, he's not consistent. The condemnation that he has vented on the Supreme Court justices over the marriage equality decision was nowhere to be found, not even in a hint, in his praise for the court over the Hobby Lobby decision that almost rewrote the religious freedom part of the First Amendment. And you didn't hear him making any criticism of the decision on campaign finance reform that basically turned the governance of the nation through campaigns over to the highest bidder. I can't take this man seriously. He's not consistent. He is really wallowing in his own grief about having lost a decision. The notorious Family Research Council has been working overtime to fan the flames of fear and paranoia among people of faith. FRC President Tony Perkins is an expert at this kind of provocation.
Look, religion is so entwined with who we are as a nation. I mean, that's why we have this nation. It was founded upon that freedom to believe, the freedom to live your life according to your beliefs. That's at stake here. And for Christians, for evangelicals, those who follow the Bible, this is not an issue that can be negotiated away.
You know, marriage has not been in all that great of shape for a long time. I understand people's interest in strengthening marriage, but instead of criticizing the Supreme Court's decision and looking at that as a slam against religion, why could this man not talk about the fact that we now have affirmed marriage equality for all citizens? And that among those who now are being recognized as married people are individuals who serve as great models for fidelity in marriage and strengthening of relationships. These are individuals who have behaved as responsible marital partners when the society around them was not even recognizing them. You know, he should have been full of praise, Tony Perkins should, instead of vitriol. Here's how it works. After groups like FRC convince conservative Christians that their religious freedom is under attack, legal groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom and Liberty Council parachute in to agitate and offer free representation in the courts. They do so in the cause of being protectors of religious freedom. Yet here's what Liberty Council founder and chairman Matt Staver had to say.
This is going to be a flood of homosexual indoctrination, gender abolition indoctrination, sexual practice experimentation, risky behavior. All of this is going to come on them like a flood. When you stick them in the public schools and they get this kind of indoctrination, you're going to lose your children.
You know, I'm tempted to say that statements like that don't even deserve a response. What scares me is to think that someone like Staver actually believes what he's saying. If our country is in trouble, it is in trouble because people don't understand the goodness of our government. They don't understand the positive nature of freedom. They don't understand how all of us can live better together if we abide by the Constitution that our founders provided for us in order that we might really be a nation of freedom and justice for all. This is a fragile time in our pluralistic society. While it may score points in the short term, this kind of irresponsible rhetoric is both unchristian and un-American. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you're hearing, then I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We really need you. We need you to help us spread the word. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. In the meantime, happy 4th of July celebration. Let it continue. And until next week, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.